Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to episode 13 of the Big COC podcast. We're here in Toronto, and I've got, wow, all these smiling faces around me. It's almost like summer, isn't it, Taya? Now, I mean,
look at this neon tank.
Yeah, I mean, I need sunglasses. Yes. So, and Taya's looking all tanned, and I mean, we finally, after the hail and the snow on Sunday here in Toronto, I don't know if you were here then. We're in the home stretch. I've got several new guests today who I'll introduce in a bit, but just first of all, welcoming back Wayne Gooding. Hi, Wayne.
How are you?
I'm good. Wayne is the editor of Opera Canada magazine, and he speaks here at the COC before the operas. He's part of the Speakers Bureau, and he's a writer on all things operatic. And I could go on, but I think I better just stop there. And so one of our first-time guests today is soprano Taya Kasahara. Hi, Taya. How are you?
Fine, thanks. How are you?
Excellent. Taya is well-known to our COC audiences. She was a member of the Ensemble Studio. She's since gone on to sing roles all across the country and beyond. This season alone, where were you in Canada singing?
I was first in Edmonton singing Olympia in Tales of Hoffman, and then Queen of the Night with Vancouver Opera, and then back here in Toronto understudying Lucia, and now we'll be doing Cherubino in Against the Grain's Figaro's Wedding.
Right, and that's a production that we're all excited to see. It's coming up soon. Now, a couple of people, you did a preview concert this afternoon. You're just fresh off that, right?
Definitely.
How did that go?
Great. It was well received.
Yeah,
we had a lot of fun. Just kind of playing with these characters in this very modern interpretation of it with a brand new English libretto by Joel Ivany, who's also artistic director of Against the Grain.
Did you guys, Stephen? You saw it today?
Absolutely, it was wonderful. And having first encountered Joel's work up in Edmonton, doing that really amazing, artistically successful Tales of Hoffman there, I really couldn't wait to check him out again. And he's done a magnificent job with this libretto. And boy, is that ever tough to do, to create a new libretto. I know, because I've done it myself on several occasions, so I was with him all the way with every line.
Right.
And really understood the sweat that he put into that. And it's very impressive work. So I can't wait to see the full production. I'm going to actually fly back to Toronto in 2 weeks, and I'm going to review it. So I'm looking forward to it.
Well, we'll get to your intro in just a second, but just to finish off with the Against the Grain production of Figaro's Wedding, it's playing here in Toronto from May 29th to June 2nd at the Burroughs Building, which is 639 Queen Street West. And if you need more information and tickets, you know, obviously you can go online and Google it. And since we've already heard his voice, I'd like to welcome Stephen Bonfield, who's here from Calgary visiting us. He's well known to Western Canadian audiences, I guess. You give lectures, is that right, before?
That's
from
right.
The Edmonton Opera and Calgary Opera performances. And what else do you do out there operatically?
Operatically speaking, I work with Opera Nuova as well, and their season is coming up. They have a very impressive season for June.
And that's a training program in Edmonton, right?
That's right, yeah, and one-of-a-kind program, and four operas that I'm looking forward to talking to you about in about however many minutes. And also with Edmonton Opera, not only just doing their pre-opera talks, but writing many of their program notes, writing their education guide, or helping with that at any rate. And also, we have Opera 101 discussions in which we invite prominent academics in the community, and we get a lot of very, very interested people coming in looking at some of the issues surrounding the opera and trying to also put the production in context too, is an exciting thing to do. So
that sounds similar to the Opera Exchange program, which
exactly,
we do here.
Yeah.
Yeah, we just had one this past Saturday, in fact, for Dialogues of the Carmelites, which went really well. Finally, today, welcoming new guest, Maddie Wilkinson. Hi, Maddie. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Now, Maddie is an intern here at the COC. She's interning in the education department, but she's recently, you just finished a degree in music history at Carleton, right?
Yes.
Which is a university in Ottawa, for any of our international listeners. And you have a particular interest in Wagner, I understand, in Wagner production.
I do, yes.
So we're probably going to, you'll certainly hone in on a certain conversation we'll be having a little bit later in the podcast. Finally, my name is Gianmarco Zagato, and I'm the Adult Programs Manager here at the COC. So I thought what we start off with today, the first story, we'll go through some of the news stories that have been happening in the opera world for the last few weeks, and there's a couple juicy ones, but one that caught my eye was a movement called Art, But Fair. It's a movement that started in Germany by a German contralto called Elisabeth Kuhlmann, and basically, to summarize it, what seems to be happening is that, you know, as much as we maybe don't want to admit it or face up, there's, you know, a lot going on economically in the world right now, sort of a worldwide economic downturn, obviously. And this has, of course, affected the opera world as well in terms of ticket sales, audience numbers. But where it's what this specific story is about is more to do with singers' fees. And as I understand the issue, traditionally, and you might be able to correct me on some of this, Taya.
We'll see.
But traditionally in Germany, singers are paid a lower per performance fee, but are recompensed for that in a sense by being paid some kind of rehearsal fee. And what's been happening is that other opera companies have been looking towards this German model, the lower fee part of it, but not necessarily paying the rehearsal fee. And there's been kind of a revolt almost. It's like a singer revolt, an artist revolt that, you know, fees are just getting lower. We're not getting paid our rehearsal fees. We've got to set ourselves up in cities for weeks before production before we get paid. And Elizabeth Kuhlmann, now most of it's in German, but there are videos of her speaking to, you know, the news people in Germany about this. So I just wonder if anyone has any ideas on this, any reflections or insider knowledge?
Can't claim insider knowledge, actually, but it is an interesting issue, and it's actually, I think, it's a horrifying issue in some ways, actually. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, most of us who go to the opera are in the audience, and really what we're interested in is what's on the stage, and we forget about the business side of it, not just from the point of view of the companies, but from the point of view of the singers. And it's not, I think, until things like this Art But Fair movement and singers speaking out, I think a lot of people are only now realizing just how the economics of singing works in terms of, you know, most of us work in the cities we live in, and for singers, often they're working elsewhere, which means there are all kinds of transportation, hospitality, and so on, costs involved in what they do, and it isn't part of the fee. I mean, when you start reading about Elizabeth Kuhlmann and the things that some of the singers have weighed in about in this debate. I mean, most industries, people working in most industries just would not tolerate it. I mean, if I go to work outside of where I live, I would expect to be, you know, compensated mm-hmm. for travel costs and all the rest of it. But that doesn't work so well. And Taya, you really are the one to talk to this, I think, since you travel a lot.
So. Yeah, well, I can't say that I have worked in Germany. I've done a little bit of singing in Europe, but just as a student, so that's a whole other story. But maybe in the past, you know, those fees have been included, or there has been compensation for that, for travel, for accommodation, and it is really nice when that is taken care of, when the artist or the singer doesn't have to go and organize that them for themselves, because that's just an added stress, especially when doing it in a different language, you know, in a foreign country. It's definitely hard. Like many singers, and I have done this on audition tours, is you go into debt first and waiting to be, mm-hmm. hopefully the payoff will come later, either getting a contract or finally being paid. And some concerts that I have done in Europe, I've been paid like months after the work had been completed. And sometimes that can be complicated with, you know, just different international currencies and banks and transfers and things that maybe were not as aware of here in Canada. You know, you just hand a check and it's easy to go to the bank and that kind of thing. But over there, it's a bit more complicated. So it can be frustrating. But I know there's like a wave of younger singers that will take those jobs because that's the work that is there. You know, and they want to have that experience and have that exposure, so they'll take the lesser fee or the contract that has no accommodation attached to it, or fee or extra fees for that. So it's kind of there are these two camps that are out
right.
there. So,
but the problem then becomes is that if the singers, younger singers, take it, they're essentially taking a lower fee, right? Willingly taking
exactly.
a lower fee, and you're kind of on a slippery slope. You know, what happens next? What's the next cut to be imposed?
Exactly.
So it's.
Well, the tenor, Canadian tenor John McMaster actually points on this. This is obviously, this story has appeared in various blogs and around, so then you get all the commenters. And I did highlight his comment because he does refer to this, that some singers are willing to take the lower fee. And, you know, what that does for the more experienced artist who's been around and is used to a certain level of fees, I suppose. And I don't know how you work with that problem.
I guess that's why we have unions too, maybe to kind of somehow mm-hmm. balance that out. For example, here in Canada, you know, there's always a minimum, so you know what you would be getting paid. But you know, working with different companies and they have different sized budgets, you can expect something different, or even negotiate something more, depending on getting a performance here, or mm-hmm. I don't know, adding rehearsal or taking away rehearsal time and that kind of thing.
Right.
So I'm not really sure about the unions in Germany and how that exactly works, but.
Well, if nothing else, this story, I think, like Wayne, you said, it's at least brought to the forefront a bit what singers are going through,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah, the reality.
How different it
how
is
hard
than
it is
what
to make
the
living,
the,
as,
you know,
as
the way most of us
unit.
Are paid to do our jobs.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things I was excited about having you here, Stephen, was that you're from Western Canada, and we don't, you know, we obviously read about performances that go on in different parts of the country, different parts of the world, but I thought we'd take advantage of your presence here today to talk a bit about the seasons, the opera seasons in Western Canada, especially Calgary and Edmonton, where you're based. Maybe starting with Calgary, because what they did this season, when we talked about this way back in September, remember, because it was the Verdi year, the anniversary of, I always get this wrong, was it Verdi's death? 100 years?
It's the 200th anniversary of his birth.
Birth, okay. And he, so they did an all Verdi season. They did three Verdi operas. And how did, first of all, like, my initial reaction to that was like, oh, that's great, but it's not much variety for the audience. But what were your impressions?
My impression is that it was an unqualified success,
mm-hmm.
Not only artistically, but at the box office.
Yeah.
The houses were full. It generated a tremendous amount of excitement. It was the Viva Verdi season. And what way to start, you know, what a way to start, but to start at the top of Mount Olympus. Their lead-off opera was Otello, which of course is just a titanic score to have to read. And I have to say, the Calgary Opera Orchestra did a supreme job. When I was there on opening night, it was really impressive. They brought out every color in that score they could. The singing was excellent. John McMaster came out and simply dominated the stage, is all I can say. And Gregory Dahl, well, Greg Dahl, I think, was dripping with bile from first moment. And did an absolutely magnificent job. Great lighting, certainly a good set that was trying to mix elements of both the Moorish and the Italian, which I thought was really, really quite well done, with the nice curvy staircase in the center. And Opera Chorus also tried to rise to that occasion and did so very well, especially in the opening Act One drinking song, which is so famous. Otello was wonderful, absolutely wonderful. And Falstaff came after that, was equally terrific with a good slate of stars. And then they concluded with Traviata, which is one of the most performed operas ever. I mean, the most performed opera of all time, if you believe the statistics. And for this, Tim Vernon from POV came out and conducted, and that was really, that's wonderful. Anytime Tim Vernon's in the pit is always a treasure.
And he's at Pacific Opera Victoria.
Absolutely,
right?
He's their music director there, and just saw him actually, Ariadne of Naxos, Opera Nuova, last June. And again, just a real treat every time he's there. And really, I think, commanded a very, very beautiful, nuanced Traviata, which I think is really very much needed. And yeah, it was quite a time. Not a bad cast at all. So overall, a very, very good season for Calgary Opera. But it gets better, because now, with the money in the bank and with being very viable, they are going to start a summer festival. They will lead off with Tracy Dahl and Brett Poligato in Pirates of Penzance. That will be third week of August, and this is a 5-day festival. I think there are plans to try and expand that one day, and maybe perhaps have two productions per summer. Make it a 10-day festival, but they're going to take it one step at a time. They're very, very good at that. So Calgary Opera is in very, very good hands and in very good shape and producing some fine quality art.
Well, where are they performing the the festival?
That's a great question, because out just east of, if you've ever been to Calgary, downtown, we have Theatre Row, and culminating in Jack Singer Hall, where the CBO performs. And now east of that, of City Hall, is an old area called the East Village. And that is being refurbished and constantly being upgraded. Already we've seen, for example, decidedly jazz performing there in outdoor festivals. So they're going to be part of that contribution to a green space and an amphitheater space where they're going to perform Pirates and subsequent operas. There's going to be kids' activities, for example, with that. So you think you can be an opera singer is going to be launched there, for example, kind of like sort of an American Idol version of that and so forth. So it's an ideal space for a lot of people. It can take several thousand people at a time. Well, eventually it will. Mm-hmm. And that's a really, really great place to cultivate this summer festival.
Right. One of my questions, though, about their season was that, I mean, they've been, of all the opera companies in Canada, they've been one of the ones that have been pioneering these new Canadian operas.
Right.
And, you know, and had, I think, quite a bit of success with it. But so in some ways, this season would seem a bit of a retrenchment from that. And, you know, maybe that's fine. But it is quite different from the seasons they've been putting on the last few years.
That is true for now, but we don't know what the future can hold.
Right.
And maybe
right.
the summer festival will be a place to actually reestablish that connection with new operas. Calgary Opera is very proud that they've launched more new operas in this country than, well, perhaps all the other companies combined.
Yeah.
That's one way to think of it. Moby Dick was the last big success, in fact, in which Lisa Di Maria was in and did a fantastic job, I have to say. And we just saw her this afternoon playing a very beautiful Rosine, I think. So, yeah, there's all kinds of great connections, not only for the Canadian content of opera, but also bringing younger Canadian rising stars. And I don't think they want to get away from that. It's just that for now, there are other priorities, and they're going to be seeking those as well.
Right. And can you talk a little bit about the Edmonton Opera season?
Oh, absolutely. it was magnificent.
Maybe Taya, too, since you were there singing.
Sure. It was terrific. Aida, of course, it's not hard to lose out on that one, but I think they broke every box office record they had with four performances of that. It went over very, very well indeed. But I think really the artistic marquee highlight was Tales of Hoffman. This is Joel Ivany's production with Camelia Koo, who did both sets and costumes for this. A fantastic cast all the way around. There wasn't a weak nanosecond in that whole thing. And the orchestra, too, I hope you agree, Teo, was just, I mean, drippingly French, magnificent in being able to convey all of the subtleties of that score, which really one needs for a work like that. And I really thought so highly of it. I couldn't get enough of it. It was magnificent. And then concluding with Eugene Onegin, which is not really done that often. It has been done, of course. And Onegin had some magnificent near all Russian cast members too, which really added to the gravitas of that performance.
Sounds great. What was your experience of that production, Taya? Did you?
Oh, it was fabulous. First of all, everyone in Edmonton was so lovely and kind, and we were treated like a family there. It was quite lovely, and yeah, to be part of a brand new production, you know, being being the person or one of the people envisioned, you know, for a specific character and how they wanted those things to come together, and there was so much detail even spent on that with the costume and the wig team at Edmonton Opera, making sure every detail was in place, and they shot high and they definitely succeeded.
Absolutely, yeah. It really showed in every detail. I mean, costuming is a great point.
Well, hopefully that production would be travel or they'll revive it at some point, because that sounds like it was a huge success.
I would hope so.
It looked great, I have to say, from the picture. It gave us our cover for this issue, actually. An image from Edmonton.
Of course.
One of the best costumes I ever had.
Well, you were tweeting all the photos, so we were like excited when we were seeing them.
Great.
It was great. It was great.
Yeah. It's hard to make Hoffman consistent across all those panels, all of those iterations of Stella. But the beautiful part at the end was that all of those women are on stage behind her at the very end. And it's almost as if in the audience's imagination they're made to merge into this one ideal form, which I was really gratified to see. That's only one of many, many great ways that the production showed good unity in its narrative.
Yeah. Well, one of the biggest opera stories over the last couple of weeks, and certainly even for the year, I'd say, was some controversy, instead of putting it mildly, around a new production of Tannhäuser at the Deutsche Oper am Rhein. It's in Dusseldorf. And it's now been sort of christened as the Nazi-themed Tannhäuser, for better or for worse. Okay, now the controversy is that there was such an upheaval in the audience after the first for showing of this production that basically the opera company pulled the production. So very few people have actually seen this thing. There's been lots of commentary. But I've just got one little description here I'm going to read just for so people have some context for what people were so upset about, or at least some people were. This comes from an article in Musical America by James Jordan. And he says, and so far as I can make out from descriptions of the production, Kosminski's big ideas, and that's the director, his big ideas, mostly involve the first 45 minutes of the opera and the finale. During the overture, there is a graphic depiction of execution by lethal gas, and then, at a pause in the scene between Venus and Tannhäuser, the hero, apparently a passive stooge for the Nazis, shoots dead a husband, wife, and child. Later, Elizabeth, who by the third act has taken the veil as a nun, is raped by Wolfram and then self-immolates, leaving a refugee child to hand an olive branch to the dying sinner. So, especially when you say it in a nutshell like that, it really does. It sounds absolutely insane, but I mean, you know, we've all had experience of avant-garde productions and some of them make sense and are well thought through, but I think the big issue here is that the opera company decided not to go ahead with the production, and a lot of the stuff I've been reading are like, well, didn't the opera, the people at the head of the opera company have wind of this ahead of time? They've obviously, productions don't just emerge within a week. There's years usually in advance of knowing about what something's going to look like and what the themes are going to be, and anyway,
yeah,
I'm really interested to know what people think
about this.
From that
point of view, it actually makes little sense. I mean, because as you say, I mean, there would have been a production meeting with the designer and director ages in advance. They knew exactly what they were going to get. If I were the board of the Deutsche Oper there, I would fire the intendant, like the general director there, because I think no matter what you think of the production, and it does sound, you know, even further off the rails than many. No matter what you think about that, it shows, for me, it shows a complete lack of artistic integrity to just cave in to a protest. I mean, I understand that people may feel strongly about it, but if you've gone with the artists, the creators and the artists all that time, and then you just cave in within, you know, 4 or 5 hours of the first performance when you knew what was coming all along, then I think credibility is just gone out the window there. There is no reason to do that, I don't think.
I mean, especially in Germany where, I mean, it seems that these types of productions are pretty well the norm. Why? Yeah. Does anyone here have any idea why? Like, why do you think the company would have taken this step?
I think what maybe doesn't come through quite so clearly in that quote or from the descriptions, what really seems to have been offensive is the Holocaust theme at the bottom and Tannhäuser essentially murdering Jews. I mean, whether he's a dupe or not, it doesn't matter. And that, you know, find that in Wagner, I challenge you. I mean, it is an add-on, but I think that in particular in Germany is what really, brought this out. Oddly enough, you know, this is the second German Tannhäuser I've come across in 12 months that's involved a gas oven. Because the current Bayreuth production, which is not set in the National Socialist period, it's in some kind of utopian commune. In that one, Elizabeth, after her final big number, puts herself into a biogas oven. And then seems to think better of the idea of killing herself, tries to come out, and Wolfram stuffs her in and locks the door on her, so essentially kills her. So it's a rather wild variation on what, you know, was going on in this one.
Yeah, it's a logical one, unfortunately, I hate to say. In 2007 in Frankfurt, when I was there for Tannhäuser, Wolfram strangles Elizabeth, in the Evening Star. So, I mean, this is, I guess, it just finally went too far, is all I can say. Although, you know, I wasn't there, there's no video, it's just hard to imagine, but certainly it's very graphic to see three people stripped, shaved on stage, and then executed in front of the audience. And, you know, hardly surprising that some people felt medically ill and sought treatment.
But it seems to have been the report that people actually had to go to hospital.
Yeah.
Right.
Really?
So,
along with the fact that Wagner, he really wanted to get into our, like, conscious mind, and his music was to push us and to push that emotional sort of feeling within us, and everything that he does, it's to kind of like evoke that within us. And so opera is a very dramatic and emotional sort of an experience, and if you really get into the music and the characters and stuff, it can be very powerful emotionally for yourself as the audience member. So if you're sitting there and you're seeing these very explicit images and you're listening to this music that is purposely designed to bring out that emotion in you, music's very powerful, and it can bring that emotion into you. And and I've spent so much time this week reading about it all, and I just to see those images, because I kept thinking about Schindler's List and Sophie's Choice and Inglourious Basterds, and those where you do see very vivid images, but I think that in combination with the music can really make that sort of psychological experience just that much more powerful and extreme. Yeah. And I think that it's a very I think it's very interesting that they went so far. I don't know if you saw any of the pictures of the production, and like there's with all the naked men in ones, and it's just so real, and it's still something that's so like within our hearts, even though it happened a long time ago.
Well, and German consciousness too, and this is always the issue that we've all read, that, you know, this is always at the forefront, is there's a need to delve into, so what was 20th century German consciousness about in having to deal with this? And it keeps coming back again and again in these productions. Although, as much as I support your contention and what you're saying, and find it very important for productions to be avant-garde and to seek this, I think that Wayne raises really a definitive point. Does the orchestration support this? And, you know, was it the Dresden or Paris? Which version did they do? And in the extra brass and in the harp line that's there, can we actually find in those harmonics a tie into the meanings of what's being explored here? So Tannhäuser is not guilty of hedonism. Now he's guilty of you know, the crime has been stepped up, according to the director. He says, why not make him a murderer of the most heinous proportion, whether it's a stooge or not? And this really, of course, takes it to such a different level, but one wonders if Tannhäuser were a murderer, if those chords would have been written quite that way.
Yeah. Well, it's speculation, isn't it? I mean, to me, from what I read of it, this was really an imposition of the worst order. That it really was, I take a point about what happens when you add music to some very graphic images, particularly Wagner's music, but it doesn't, to what end was it? I still haven't quite figured out how this production plays itself all the way through. I mean, what happens in the end? I mean, what happens in the Rome narration? What happens at that?
Right.
I can't quite fathom.
Well, I thought what we'd finish with today, sort of on a more positive note, although I have my opinions on this, is that there's just a story recently in Screen Digest that pointed out that opera is now the number one attraction in event cinema. And actually, I didn't even know what event cinema was, but it made sense to me afterwards. Because now, I think, movie theaters have moved with the times. They show movies, obviously, but they're not making quite enough. So now they show things like opera. We see ballet. We see National Theatre from London, sporting events, this sort of thing. And of all that group of events, opera apparently is taking 37% share of the pie. And obviously this is due to largely to the Met HD performances. Mm. And I guess this is a good thing. I mean, what do you guys think? Is it, is it all positive, or is there any other side to it? I don't lead you too much, but I have my ideas on this. What were you going to say, Maddie?
Well, I did a paper last year on outreach programs for my final directive reading course, and the Met actually did a study in mid-2000s about who was coming to the operas, and they did it every few years, and they realized it was the same group because the age group kept getting older. So part of the reasoning behind the HD performances was so that younger audiences could afford to go watch the opera. They also did a lot of, they'd actually go into the schools and they'd live feed it right in their schools so that students, and they'd have like a field trip almost to the opera. And so I know that was part of the main purpose, was it was for the people who can't necessarily afford to go see an opera can actually go see one on a Saturday afternoon. So I think in that sort of sense, like, that is positive. Mm-hmm. Hopefully people will take that as that own experience, because actually going and seeing an opera is a very different experience.
Definitely, yeah. Do you go to some of the HDs, Stephen?
Oh, I certainly do, mm-hmm. and I enjoy them very much. Mm-hmm. I wanted to sort of follow that up with a small point, and then a much bigger point, which will be sort of filled with unbridled enthusiasm. Fortunately, Wayne is here to check that, and I'm hoping that you'll sort of weigh in a little bit on what I'm going to say, but there have always been, of course, controversies with the HD productions in terms of taking money away from other means of and formats of opera and how this is dispensed. For example, and you know, live ticket sales, of course, are down in New York, it's thought of, because of the HD productions, and this has been discussed on this podcast as well. Mm. But I think my way of seeing it is that we're actually witnessing the splintering of opera in, I think, a productive way. Back in the 20th century, we had live opera, and then we had recordings of operas, and then low-resolution videos of operas. Mm-hmm. And, of course, if you had reprojection, you could, you know, really make your own home theater out of all of this. But now we've got high-definition broadcast. We've got Blu-ray, and Blu-ray in and of itself is like a different medium, because you can go home, make your own theater out of all of that that's now in crystal clear definition, as if you're in the front row without having to crane your neck at the surtitles. But then we've also got ways of distributing this through iPods and getting samples. And now we've also got companies like Against the Grain, who are revising and representing and doing operas in very, very different ways. So we don't have opera as one sort of unified medium anymore. What's happened is we've got multiple ways of taking in opera from multiple perspectives, because framing an opera on a big movie screen or on a television screen or in your ears or in a theater amounts to me to being four different cognitive experiences. Mm. And so I think there are different impressions of what opera can, is, or could be, depending on how you like to take it in. You know, what is your favorite medium? I'm certain that there are a lot of people who only go to the movie theater, and they only know opera in that one way. But that is, I think, a very, very different experience from actually taking it in live, mm-hmm. at different points in different houses and in different acoustics. So I think seeing this bigger part of the pie is reflective not just of HD broadcast, but of the multiple availabilities of different types of opera transmissions and opera media. And to me, this can only be good for opera. For all of the small disadvantages on either side of the curve fit of what's good here, mm-hmm. I think it's worth it to give it that much more exposure and put it in sort of the currency of modernity and technology.
Yeah, I agree with everything you say, except maybe that it's a good thing.
Except that part.
Except that. No, so I'm joking, actually.
No.
What you're saying is interesting, and you're absolutely right. I mean, in that period when we all had available recorded opera, we could watch DVDs at home, I don't think I ever posed a threat or put any kind of pressure on live opera. I mean, I think we separate that. I'm not so sure that's true of the live in HD broadcast, the cinema events you're talking about, mm-hmm. here, that these are actually now becoming an alternative for many people, perhaps because of where they live, for one thing. But no matter what, even here in cities which are served by, or in cities that are served by live companies, as an alternative to going to the opera. And it's everyone, every week at these broadcasts says, there's nothing to replace the experience of live opera. And there isn't. We all know that. Absolutely. But it doesn't matter to a lot of people, mm-hmm. that it isn't the same experience. They are really enjoying the experience of the cinema screen, of opera on the cinema screen. And that's where I think it starts. I'm a big fan of it as well, but I mean, we're kind of all sitting around this microphone and kind of in a rather unique position. You know, Taya, you're working on the stage, and we're quite involved in, you know, seeing them for professional reasons. Yeah, so it's a whole different, our perspective is a little bit skewed in that sense, because we're going to go to the live experiences anyway. What bothers me about them is things like sound, or rather the expectations that are being created in audiences. Singers do not sound the way they do. Yeah. Even the big name singers do not sound in the theater the way they do in the cinema, and I think audiences are getting used to loud bright sound that they will never experience in the cinema, in live theater. And I think the worry there is, frankly, that it will be seen, this theater will be seen as an inferior experience in this respect alone. And if that's important to them, then to the viewer, then they'll leave it where it is. I mean, there is an issue. I just came back from the Opera America conference in Vancouver, and I kept hearing over and over again about how the subscription from the companies now, how the subscription model is broken, how every economic model in which all the companies have operated up to now are broken, and they need to find new ways of doing it and face up to new pressures like live in HD, you know, Blu-ray at home, which is a whole different experience from low definition. So I don't think it's necessarily a good thing here, or at least it's a problematic thing that is going to force a lot of adaptation on the company's parts, and in some ways could be quite threatening.
Absolutely, and I wouldn't deny that for a moment. I think the reason I remain enthusiastic and optimistic is because I think it's just a question of catching up, that these companies have to make an adjustment just like anything else. I mean, imagine being a devout fan of a great pianist, and suddenly the pianist sounds so fantastic on a recording in the 1950s and 60s, and then one goes to recital and sits at a certain point where it's not quite like having my head inside the piano where I can hear every chord so clearly. I know that theater is, of course, much different. I mean, it's a much grander synthesis, of course. But in some ways, too, I think that human beings being so polysensory and in real need of that stimulus are going to seek out the live attraction if and when they can, and will come back to it now having been reignited with the HD experience. And I think with only a little bit of education, they'll come to see that they're actually at two different kinds of art medium.
Mm-hmm. Do many of your singer friends like talk about this, the effect of maybe the HD on perceptions of voices, like Wayne was talking about much?
Uh-huh.
Or have you thought about it?
No, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that can be quite disconcerting too for us singers.
Sure.
Also, is a big thing is body image too.
I
have colleagues that are at a variety of kind of acquaintance or something like that, and they sometimes they're tweeting or their Facebooking status is saying getting HD ready, you know, going to the gym, you know, and there's a big pressure I think on singers to look good, to look like celebrities and models these days too. So that's another added stress that I think we have because of this whole HD wave or having, you know, opera in the theaters. But I do think it is catching a broader audience, you know, and that might pique their interest to want to see live theater too.
Yeah, that's the hope.
You know, that is the hope, definitely. But there also could be, well, I'm not really sure I like this live experience, you know, but I really haven't heard many people say, well, I didn't enjoy the live experience, you know, coming from just something that's been recorded or even a live broadcast or something like that. Because it always is so special and so unique when you are there, you know, in that energy, in that space with all those people, right?
Yeah.
So
it's a very highly stimulating milieu, and I don't think human beings are going to want to give that up. It's been around since ancient Greece, and I don't think it's going anywhere anytime soon.
That's great. That's really positive. I like that.
it's the problem, though, isn't it? Of weighing the $25 experience, which can be very intense, and the $180, $200 experience. I mean, ticket to have a similar and analogous experience close up in the theater. And once you start playing with that kind of economics, then strange things happen, I think.
Yeah, that's very true. We have to be guarded about that. Even I have to be guarded about that. So
it's
very tough to argue against.
You know, and given the huge, we all know the huge expense of putting on live opera.
Exactly.
I mean, it's very hard for an opera company to make all their tickets, you know, $40.
Absolutely.
Which even sounds high to some people, but I mean, you know, that's just the reality.
One just a very quick example from the Opera America conference, one that was, I found, very helpful. There was actually a whole session on live streaming and cinema geared to the companies. And one of the speakers was from San Francisco Opera, and they've had great success for the last few seasons streaming one of their productions to Giant Stadium. And they get this huge audience out, you know, that want to go experience opera on the big screen outdoors in Giant Stadium. But they've done it for long enough that they've been actually tracking. I mean, they actually, it's free, but they kind of make you sign up to capture email addresses and all this kind of thing. And they actually figure that over the, I can't remember how many years, 5 to 8 years they've actually been doing this now, that they think they've generated in the theater about over a million dollars worth of ticket sales as a follow-on. Now, that's a very positive story, and you know, to what you were saying, and you know, hopefully it all goes like that.
Yeah, you know,
so it had me thinking, though. You know, so why doesn't the COC, you know, live stream to Rogers Center or something?
I don't know.
On a day like today,
it'd be wonderful. Yeah.
Well, I think it's definitely something I'm hoping that, you know, the powers that be are looking towards. But I mean, this whole HD thing has become such a huge phenomenon. We keep coming back and chatting about it here and into different guises, but I think that's it's needed because, as I've said before, we're in the midst of the beginning of this sort of new thing. And no doubt in 10 years we'll be talking about some other new technology that will have superseded it.
Oh, without a doubt.
But I think it's good to talk about it and to talk about its effect on audiences and opera companies because those things are real. Well, thank you all very much for joining me today. It's been really a great discussion. And I just want to remind our listeners that you can listen to our podcast several ways. You can go on coc.ca, check out COC Radio, where you can listen directly on the website. You can also download MP3s from the website. And finally, the ever-popular iTunes, which is probably the best way to subscribe. And then you'll always be updated when a new podcast is available. And you can leave comments there or on Facebook or Twitter or Parlando, our blog. There's lots of ways to contact us, and we really do enjoy hearing from you. So until the next time, this is Gianmarco Sagato at the Canadian Opera Company, and we hope to hear you again soon. Bye-bye.